So last time we talked about the theory of Rav Lichtenstein's approach to secular studies and what's often called Torah Umada or Torah V'Chachma. And today we're going to do two different things. First, we're going to look at responses and objections to the Torah Umada approach, targeted usually, sometimes we'll see directly at Rav Lichtenstein, sometimes implicitly. And then we're going to start on the issue of secular studies in practice. We're going to look at a couple of different approaches, a couple of different papers that analyze Rav Lichtenstein's PhD that's been published as a book. And we'll look at that. And next time we'll finish that piece of things. So just to review, Rav Lichtenstein's position is that while Torah is central, there's value in several different ways of studying secular wisdom. It both helps enhance your Torah knowledge, it helps in all sorts of pragmatic ways functioning in the world, and maybe most of all, it helps make you a better religious person. And that's why he advocates studying a whole range of different things, not as a replacement to Torah and not even as a primary thing, but as something that one should spend some time on during their formative years of education. Now, there's a few different angles with which one might object to this approach. We should just say, even though Rav Lichtenstein did write, the first programmatic article on this, and really several long pieces, he's not alone. Rabbi Lan wrote a book called Torah Umada that picks up on similar themes with some different focuses. We're not going to get into that. There's like a Hasidic view that he actually favors. That overlaps in some ways, but is actually different than Rav Lichtenstein's view. We're not going to get into that, but we will look at some of the responses, the negative attitudes towards Torah Umada, either in general or specifically Rav Lichtenstein's view. Now, one position that one might take in objecting to Torah Umada is to say, I really don't see any value whatsoever in secular studies. What can it give you? Everything's in Torah. And this objection was addressed by Rav Lichtenstein, but you might not buy his response. You might say, everything's in Torah, there's no value in anything else, we should just sit and learn. If we need to work, we should get a job. But beyond that, there's no value in secular wisdom. Why should looking at some non-Torah perspective help me as a religious Jew? So I didn't even bring a quote for that, because it's sort of straightforward, and I guess if you had that position, you wouldn't necessarily write a nice lengthy article on it. You'd have to learn how to write and things like that, which are unnecessary for your spiritual life. So that's one approach, which just pointed out, as Rav Lichtenstein did. Another approach, also noted by Rav Lichtenstein and responded to, is one about the dangers of secular studies. Not that they're worthless or meaningless, maybe they even have value, but there's a certain danger attached. Mm-hmm. And for this, the classic article, that's only 30 years ago, is by Rabbi Yehuda Parnas, who at the time was a Rosh Yeshiva here. He subsequently moved to Landers. And it's a four-page article, but it's an article nonetheless, in the Torah Umada Journal, ironically enough. And he writes, the position of Torah Umada is surprisingly simple. It posits that in addition to an unequivocal and preeminent commitment to Talmud Torah, there is also a need to be involved in the intellectual and cultural experience of mankind. And that formulation sounds very similar with what we've seen from Rav Lichtenstein. You know, the fact that non-Jews don't need to study Torah doesn't mean Jews shouldn't study Chachma. In fact, Jews should be no less competent in the area of Chachma. So that's his restatement of Rav Lichtenstein's view, and really Rabbi Lam's as well. There is, however, a serious halachic hurdle that Torah Umada must overcome before it can claim bona fide standing. And he quotes the Rambam in Avodah Zarah. Rav Lichtenstein related to this as well, where the Rambam prohibits freedom of inquiry in areas of idolatry and heresy. I didn't bring the quote, but basically it says if you study something that could lead you to a heretical position, that's prohibited. So what Rabbi Parnas concludes is that though freedom of inquiry is generally a desirable and appropriate approach, with respect to areas of thought that are essentially heretical, halacha imposes a prohibition, ruling out free intellectual inquiry. And he also says, if you really believe in the academy, free intellectual inquiry is what it's all about. So we have a frontal contradiction here. And he says, well, maybe the Rambam is saying only if you're studying for the purposes of becoming a heretic is it prohibitive. That's not a good reading of the Rambam. And then he addresses the obvious question. If the Rambam didn't believe in Torah Umada, then how did he write several long treatises on matters relating to philosophy? So how could that possibly be? And he says there's this idea of lehavin ulahoros, that if you're a Talmud Chacham who studies things in order to understand and make halachic decisions, you can study even Kishuv, even Avodah Zarah, for the purposes of making halachic decisions. So the Rambam was a halachic decisor. He needed to study these things, but no one else, it doesn't really apply to anyone else. And if you're going to study anything, you need to have very strict limits on freedom of inquiry. And this idea of studying wisdom for its own sake is very dangerous and should largely be avoided. He doesn't say, his conclusion is Torah Mitzvah is only viable if it imposes strict limits. He doesn't go to the full extent and say, anything is a risk and not worth it, though one could go in that direction. But that's another objection. So just to summarize quickly the two objections that you might call from the right or on the Torah side of things is what value does it have at all? And of course there are hybrid positions that may say, well, there's value in studying science and appreciating God's creation of the world, but there's no value in studying humanities or literature or history. That's all silly and meaningless. And Rav Lichtenstein actually responded to those. We saw this last time in his The End of Learning lecture and article, where he responds, how could you not focus on God's creation of humanity? That's such an important part of the world. But you could say there's really no value in it, or you could say there are dangers. That's one direction of objection, and Rav Lichtenstein responds to that fairly directly in his programmatic articles. But there's also a different objection that really focuses on the Mada side of things. That says Mada, as Rav Lichtenstein presents it, the humanities as he sees it and as he presents it in his writings, aren't quite the way things work in the academy nowadays. And funny enough, the first person to make this point was actually Rav Lichtenstein himself in Centrist Orthodoxy, which was published in 2003. It was written, I think, in the 80s originally. Starting with the question of general culture, it's in the middle of that essay. I wrote a brief essay in the 60s, setting forth my position with respect to the validity and value of such culture and its relation to the dual problems of Bittul Torah and potentially pernicious influences. This is a consideration of synthesis from a Torah point of view, the first essay that we looked at in depth last time. So he says, I freely admit that during the intervening years between the 60s and the 80s when this was written, confidence in culture in Arnold's sense, the study of perfection, has been generally shaken. For at least three reasons. First, high culture, the best that has been thought and said in the world, as Arnold defined literature, is less cherished than it once was. Interest in the humanities has waned, both within academia and outside of it. Focus shifted to more pragmatic and technological areas. Not only have priorities changed, but to most people, the kind of spirit which animated in Arnold to posit literary culture as the one dam restraining the flood tide of barbarian anarchy now seems hopelessly naive. It's this idea that there's great literature and we should all focus on the great literature and that this is what's holding up the world and preventing anarchy, that's outdated. No one really believes that anymore in the academy. So Rav Lichtenstein himself is aware of that challenge, of that weakness in his approach to Torah and culture, Torah and Mada, however you want to define it. And that critique is picked up on and broadened by William Kohlbrenner. It's actually an interesting fellow. He did a PhD in Columbia on literature in really the same field as Rav Lichtenstein, and then he became religious. He actually became Haredi and moved to Israel. So his critique is going to come at, and he's a literature professor at Bar-Ilan. So his critique is going to come at Rav Lichtenstein from two different angles, both on the literature side and from a religious perspective. And he says, and this is published in 2004, there was an issue of the Jewish Action in honor of Rav Lichtenstein's 70th birthday. And one of the things they had was a critical angle on Torah Umada, on consideration of synthesis. So he writes, there are, I think, two reasons to hesitate at the enterprise of Torah Umada as Rav Lichtenstein conceives of it. First, the nature of our students and contemporary culture. And second, more fundamentally, the nature of the university and the forms of attention and inquiry that it encourages. And he has two basic problems. One, he talks about how he meets with these modern Orthodox students and tries to figure out why they believe in Torah Mada, but at the same time aren't interested in actually reading any of the literature that they say they believe in reading. And it comes out a little cynical, but he says he remains confused by the disparity between their enthusiasm for the concept of Torah Mada and their indifference to the actual phenomenon, until one of the guys said, it's not so much that we're interested in Torah Mada, what we really want is Torah and entertainment. And he says popular culture, movies, MTV, and that's what they really want. That's why they say they believe in Torah Umada. Actually, in a subsequent article, Religion and Culture, Kohlbrenner takes this a step further. It says not only are students not interested in learning, but maybe there are some who can do it. He makes the claim that even university students in literature classes don't know how to read anymore. And there's been a decline in reading ability due to technology. no one really reads anything. People skim maybe, but you're always on multiple devices, you're always multitasking, and you're never actually in and focused on one thing. So you know, we're in a classroom, it's interesting to reflect on that, maybe in the discussion. So that's his critique from the side of the students, which as you'll notice is both on the academic side, but there's also a religious element, right? If their students only want the secular studies because it's culture and they can watch movies, so maybe there's no religious value in that. But then he says it's not just the young people who have changed, it's also the university has changed. The academic scene has changed, which Rav Lichtenstein himself admitted, as we just saw. But he says Rav Lichtenstein didn't realize the full extent of the shift. And it's changed, you know, he calls it an earthquake, and it's really shifted significantly. In the contemporary university, what were once considered the classics of Western literature and philosophy are now often viewed as mere markers of prejudice, power, and oppression. You'll in your average literature class, and I assume those of you who took these courses experienced this, you'll ask questions about race, gender, and you know, culture, and different questions like that. And that's sort of the way you look at it. You know, how is this author privileging white culture or bourgeois culture or the male perspective? And that's generally the way literature is studied in the university classroom. So there's no reason to expect that Rav Lichtenstein would keep up with the developments in the contemporary university, but T.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, and Matthew Arnold, all of whom Rav Lichtenstein quotes a fair amount, rarely find themselves in the undergraduate curriculum. Certainly those bearers of Christian humanism find very few sympathetic ears within the walls of the contemporary university. And that's where he continues on this point that Rav Lichtenstein, when he talks about Torah Ramadan, and especially literature, it's about a profound engagement with the text and how that relates to one's religious life. To read the text to see what lines up with one's religious life, what doesn't quite fit, and to try to be ennobled by that experience. The problem is, again, that the university as it's currently conceived, and even a religious university, does not always allow students within the structure of a classroom to foreground their own moral and theological perspectives. The idea of saying, okay, this is a Christian perspective, we need to modify it in these ways because we're Orthodox Jews, but we can adopt those aspects. That wouldn't really come up in the classroom. And so then, finally, read the last paragraph here. I do not demur from Rav Lichtenstein's evaluation of the intrinsic value of the classics of the Western tradition, but rather the role of the classics, given the institutional frameworks currently available in the life of the Ben Torah. In the 50s and 60s, the Torah found itself in America at home in a culture that was hospitable to the ideals of religious humanism. The problem of synthesis may have been a genuine avoda for that generation. The chore of the current generation, in a very different climate, may require not synthesis, but rather simply maintaining the forms of attention required to receive and transmit the Torah. So maybe now back in the day when the university could offer that and when Orthodox Judaism in America needed it, that was the way to go. But nowadays we really should change our perspective. So that's a strong critique of Torah Ramadan as Rav Lichtenstein views it. He responds in that section and says, well, it seems like we basically agree. We both believe in Torah Ramadan. The question is whether it's doable in the current university setting. So maybe we have to keep trying, keep pushing back, and see if we can get it to work. But he doesn't dispute the critique that the university has changed. And at the same time, he says we still need to work at it. Another critique, actually, from this university, an article in the Commentator. I have the online version of it. Article published in the Commentator in February of 2006, just slightly over 12 years ago, by Sarah Rindner. A consideration of synthesis from a student point of view. A response to Rav Lichtenstein. Right? So you know the plan words. Consideration of synthesis from a Torah point of view. And she quotes Rav Lichtenstein about the value of studying secular studies and how literature ennobles a person. And her response is, when I first read these words during my year in Israel, they strengthened my decision to go to college in a Jewish environment. You know, she was excited about integrated pursuit of wisdom that would color every aspect of the day. And there was a challenge when she actually encountered the classroom. As she writes, some of the most searching problems, or searing problems, maybe that's a typo, raised by the literature I've encountered have involved man's sense of isolation in the universe, or the complexities of human conflicts, in contrast to coherent moral and philosophical frameworks. So you read literature, you don't get, here's a theory of how to live the ethical life. That's not at least what she experienced. You saw these human conflicts. With the possible exception of explicitly devotional poems, Milton, George Herbert, the bulk of the Western literature I have read and grown to love has seemed intent on taking us into the depths of human suffering and the chaos of belief without entirely lifting us out. Right? So you end up not ennobled, but almost challenged in these ways. The Odyssey is most compelling precisely when the gods don't take care of Odysseus, and he seems to be in his excruciating journey alone. She gives other examples of this as well. I still cannot imagine how Rav Lichtenstein's Torah-centered ideal of synthesis could function in a serious college English literature class, even with the most religiously grounded of students. The supplementary ancillary model of secular education that Rav Lichtenstein lays out, however inspiring it is from a Torah point of view, does not create the kind of students who would make our English professors proud. Right? If you would, again, this is a similar point to what Kohlbrenner said, that if you show up in class and say, okay, well, here's my view of this from an Orthodox Jewish perspective, that's not what you're supposed to do in class, according to the English professors. Purveyors of the Western literary tradition ask for a similar personal engagement that our rabbis ask of us. But they want you to engage as a Western literary critic, rather than as an Orthodox Jew. It's unreasonable to expect committed students to stop listening or being attracted to secular perspectives after those ideas cross a certain line. So again, there's an objection along similar lines from Sarah Widner, given the nature of the current contemporary classroom and what's studied in. You know, she went to Stern, so it's really close to home. And finally, a very recently published critique of more of Rav Lichtenstein's thought overall, but it also touches on this, by Gil Pearl in an article in the Lehr House. So he writes about how, as a student in the Gush, he really felt that his whole Hashkafa was based on Rav Lichtenstein, and that Rav Lichtenstein, in his article on faith, talks about how he has a certain faith that his teachers dealt with and solved all the problems relating to Orthodoxy, and that he, at a certain point, when he was in graduate school, he did a PhD at Harvard on the Netziv. So while he was, I guess, also when he was in college, possibly, he came to the realization that there were challenges that might not have been met. So he says that the towering presence of modern Orthodoxy's original luminary, the Rav, or Joseph B. Soloveitchik, is sorely missed, and his outsized student, intellectual successor, and philosophical ambassador of Lichtenstein is also not here. While their writings have a deservedly hallowed place on the shelves of the serious modern Orthodox student, their content, for many of modern Orthodoxy's young and hungry minds, comes up short. The brisker dialectics, Neo-Kantian categories, Hegelian syntheses, Miltonian sensitivities, and Kierkegaardian paradoxes, which dominate their writing, speak with unmatched eloquence and profundity to the problems of modernity. Yet the questions plaguing the community that continues to look to these works for guidance are less frequently the questions of modernity and more frequently the questions of postmodernity. So this critique is coming not from the perspective of the changing nature of education, which also relates to postmodernity, but this is coming from postmodernity itself. The issues that people are concerned with are less how to fit into the modern world as a believing person, and are more about questions of postmodernity, how to find any truth system, why to believe in any objective value system overall, right? Rather than saying we believe in modernity, we believe in Torah, how do we put these together? You're saying, should I believe in anything? Is there any coherent theory that brings everything together? Today's students are less bothered by their inability to reconcile seemingly competing value systems as they are by their inability to determine whether objective value systems do or ought to exist at all. It's not the incongruence of their world that motivates their angst as much as its fluidity. Boundaries taken for granted only a generation ago are increasingly evaporating. So that's the critique from Gil Pearl, which is that, you know, maybe literature is valuable if you're trying to understand Western tradition and you want to think about Torah, right? You want to think about Torah and Western thought and how they relate to one another. That may be a worthwhile endeavor, but that's the endeavor of, you know, 30 years ago or 50 years ago, depending on when you think the shift happened to postmodernism. And Rav Lichtenstein, who wrote his PhD in the 60s, in the 50s rather, is living in an outdated world. And the questions he's dealing with, just like the questions the Rav was dealing with, don't exactly relate. So that's not a critique of the model of Torah Ramah, it just points that to the need to deal with new questions. So there's a few different possible resolutions or responses to these critiques. One is what Rav Lichtenstein said. We saw it, right? Okay, there are challenges now. It's harder to do this in the academy, but this is the way to do it, to look at the best of what's been written and thought in the West, and to look at Torah, and to try to find a way of optimizing their interaction. That's what we need to do, and if the academy makes it difficult, we need to keep on keeping on. Right? We need to do our best to push back against that. Kohlbrenner, actually, in his more recent article, Religion and Culture, says that he has a slight variation on this, which is that we need to view university education, which he warmed up to between the two articles, we need to view it as less about content. Okay, here's the Western thought, here's the modern content, here's the Torah content, and more about just the method of reading and of listening and of being able to encounter other things. Maybe that's the value in secular education. And he actually sees some religious value in that as well. But that's just another way of trying to respond to the academy and try to have secular studies in some form. So that's one approach. That's one response. Another response, as an alternative of what where to go from here, is I think what Gil Pearl points towards in his article, which we didn't see all of, we saw a small piece of, which is to take a postmodern approach, you know, that's what the critique is based on, and to follow Rav Shagar, who's we've seen earlier in the semester on Gemara study, with a focus on creativity and on self-expression. Torah Ramad is not about finding these lofty ideas and integrating them into our personality to make us better. It's about self-expression, bringing ourselves to the table and using what's out there to better express ourselves. Rav Lichtenstein himself was very much opposed to this idea, but that's the approach that Rabbi Pearl suggests. And the third response, a third possible response to these critiques that may allow for some secular education is to find a different field. If literature and really the humanities in the modern academy don't quite fit, so maybe we have to find other areas of study where there's a more clear interaction. That can come about in several different ways, but for some people, let's say studying science, right? Science doesn't have this challenge. Science is still gives you a better appreciation of God's world, though that's not what Rav Lichtenstein focused on. Or maybe philosophy, especially analytic philosophy, it hasn't really been subject to these changes in the same way. And there's some people, including students of Rav Lichtenstein, who have entered the field of philosophy. And I think maybe the largest field that people enter that maybe avoids these problems to some degree is Jewish studies. Because it's dealing with Jewish content, it gives you added perspectives, but that brings with it its own set of problems that we're going to discuss next time. So that's really at least a quick survey of some responses, some objections to Rav Lichtenstein's view of Torah Ramada and Rav Lichtenstein's response to them. We'll now look at the other source sheet, part two of today, which is really part one of Rav Lichtenstein's practice of secular study. We're going to look at the way that he interacted with literature from two parts. The first part is based on his doctorate. And there's a picture of the much more nice-looking, originally bound cover here. The doctorate was on Henry Moore, a 17th century thinker and a Cambridge Platonist. He was a professor at Cambridge and a rational theology. We'll talk about what that means. And there's been one published article and one unpublished lecture that relate to this topic. Rabbi Carmi, a couple of years ago, published an article called Music of the Left Hand. The left hand because Rav Lichtenstein's right hand was studying Torah, so to speak, and his left hand or writing about Torah, and his left hand was writing about secular studies or doing that sort of work. And he analyzes this book, among other things. And everyone should have both sheets. The other piece is an unpublished lecture by David Landes that I was lucky enough to hear in person, and then he sent me his notes. He presented it on May 24th, 2015, on Shavuos, on the rational theology of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. The two share a fair amount in common, but have some additional emphases in one that aren't in the other. And just again, we talked about this in the first class, but just to remind ourselves, Rav Lichtenstein started his PhD in 1953 at age 20 and finished it in 57, 4 years later. The book was published 5 years after that. I guess I had to go through the academic press and some editing. And he studied with Douglas Bush, who was both a religious individual and a leading professor of literature at Harvard. And Rav Lichtenstein spent the first few years at YU teaching literature at Stern. So he was in the field for a few years, even though that wasn't his preferred option, before he became a full-time Torah teacher. Among other things, Douglas Bush's method was focused on history and philology, right? To look at these writings, this literature, in historical context, and figure out what they were saying in that context and how they fit in with the history around them. Interestingly enough, he was an opponent of the New Criticism. If you'll recall Rav Lichtenstein's article, Criticism in Kitvei HaKodesh, about studying Tanakh using literary methods focused specifically on New Criticism and said that New Criticism might be a good method for studying Tanakh. His doctoral advisor was actually opposed to that method, interestingly enough. But for our purposes, Rav Lichtenstein's thesis on Henry Moore was very much in that model. It's historically based. He looks at Henry Moore and his companions and the issues they're dealing with in the 17th century. He looks closely at his writings and tries to evaluate how he treats the issue at hand. The analysis is much more focused on concepts and ideas rather than on the writing itself. So it's not, we think of literature often about the words that are used and focusing on that, but really it's, in a sense, it could be seen as almost a historical analysis of the author, which makes sense given Douglas Bush's approach. Fine. So Rabbi Karmi gives a bit of the survey about this piece. He says why it's valuable to study to understand Rav Lichtenstein's work, and he has a quote from the book that Rav Lichtenstein is attracted to Moore's personality because he is thoroughly dominated by the quality which he probably prized above all others, the quality of sincerity. This quality guarantees that his religious struggles are real. And so in a sense, Rav Lichtenstein's analysis of Moore is almost a foil, is almost like a projection of his own thoughts on the issue, and he has an opportunity in this book to not just present what Henry Moore thought, but to critique them, and you get a sense of Rav Lichtenstein's own approach to that as well. The major problem studied in the book is on the place of intellect in religious life, right? How much religion is about the mind and study. And as we've seen the past couple of weeks, that's certainly a central theme in Rav Lichtenstein's approach to religion, right? Talmud Torah is central. So this is going to be an important issue. So the first chapter of content talks about the idea of deformity, with the deity, God, and taking the form of God in a sense, meaning the ability of a human being to become like God and attain pure godliness directed by pure reason, which is an optimistic idea to see that people have the ability to transcend themselves and become godly. Obviously, there's parallel ideas to this in Judaism as well. So that's one approach that Henry Moore has that Rav Lichtenstein seems to like. But then there's another point that Henry Moore has that Rav Lichtenstein objects to, which is Moore's de-emphasis of strenuous intellectual activity in the name of morality and religious egalitarianism. If our goal is for everyone to be able to participate in religion, so there's a need to make it easy and accessible. So if you have strenuous intellectual engagement as a necessary requirement, it's a lot harder for people to engage, and that's why Moore's approach is to de-emphasize the religious aspect. So Rav Karmi brings a few quotes from various pages that critique this. I'll just read one from page 201 here on the bottom here. In emphasizing social conduct, right, interpersonal action, we move, in short, from the proper ends of religion towards the logical goals of a secular morality, from the worship of God to the service of man, from the realm of inner vision to the world of outer action. Right, this focus on action rather than on intellection, on thinking, and on one's own relationship with God, and focusing instead on the relationship with other people is a good way to undermine the idea of religion as service of God, and instead have religion be about your society, running society, which is for Rav Lichtenstein not quite a good thing. And Rav Karmi mentions that the goal here is that one shouldn't just be adapting orthodoxy to modernity from a Jewish perspective, or find the formula to live in both worlds, but the quest for virtue must involve the whole man, the intellect included, social responsibility included. The expectation is that religious people are supposed to see their relationship with God as central, and not just a way of living in the world and balancing things as central. And that's Rav Lichtenstein's critique of Moore that also points to his own approach, to orthodoxy, his own theology. In the Landes material, just to jump ahead, he points out that along the way, Rav Lichtenstein provides a mini survey of the various approaches that are taken to resolve the problem of the relationship between religion and the intellect, and he presents on Judaism And he says that in Judaism, God must be served with the head as well as with the hands and the heart. Intellection is an integral aspect of the religious experience of every individual. Study is a universal daily duty. It need not be pragmatic, as the intellectual question for God is its own justification. So basically, he's critiquing Henry Moore for not believing in Talmud Torah, in a sense, right? That because his Christian approach is more about interacting with other people and being godly in that way, and it misses out on the intellectual side and on Talmud Torah, as Judaism has it, there's a real gap here, something that's really missing in his approach. And then Rolifstein says that we do have the democratic problem, right? How can we involve everyone if there's a challenge of, you know, that it's difficult to study on a high level for everyone? And he basically says, you know, that's the challenge. Everyone has to try to meet it as best they can, and maybe poskim decide the halacha, but everyone's expected to study Torah. And that's really his resolution, is that, you know, Talmud Torah is so important that even if you lose a little bit on the egalitarian or democratic side, that not everyone can do it, that's a sacrifice he's willing to make. Towards the end of the book, both Roy Carmi and Landes, Dr. Landes, point to this. Rav Lipson talks about what exactly it means to have a rational theology. And if we just jump towards the bottom of page 3, here's a quote from Rav Lichtenstein in the book. On my view, the term rational theology ought to mean something else entirely than the way Henry Moore and John Tulloch had it mean. It should apply to a theology which recognized the exercise of man's intellectual faculties as an integral and indispensable aspect of his religious life. That's what rational theology means. The rational theology means that your thinking is a core aspect of your religion, which sees the attempt to understand God and his will as an essential phase of human activity, which looks upon study and intellectual endeavor as fundamental virtues, which finally incorporates the search for knowledge, whether as an end or as a means, as a facet of the religious realm proper. That searching for knowledge, understanding God and understanding God's teachings itself, is the core of religion. And that's how Rav Lichtenstein himself understands rational theology. So he sort of disagrees with Henry Moore's understanding of it and his approach in general, and says that we need Talmud Torah to be a more central aspect of our belief system. So it's really fascinating to see how much, you know, there is an analysis of Henry Moore, for sure, in the thesis, but how much Rav Lichtenstein's own hashkafa comes forth as well. Even though, of course, it's not meant to be a personal theology. It's not meant to be Rav Lichtenstein's own theology in the book, but it definitely shines through in several different ways. And we'll just close with a quote from Landes towards the end of his talk. He says, "When I read Rav Lichtenstein's book, I was overwhelmed by the realization that Rav Lichtenstein took his religious philosophy that he developed when he was 24 years old, right when he finished his thesis, and proceeded to live his entire life by it. A life without simple solutions, a life with constant maximum effort, and a life lived continuously and consciously in the presence of God." And that's the argument of both of these writers, that Rav Lichtenstein's own hashkafa, his own religious belief system, you can already see more or less fully formed in his thesis on Henry Moore.